Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I am joined by Sam, and we're going to be continuing our discussion of the original Spider-Man clone saga. This time we'll be covering Amazing Spider-Man number 148 to 151 from 1975. Sam, how are you doing tonight?
I am wonderful, John. How are you?
I am doing well. Now, last time we talked about the first kind of four issues we read on this, and again, with this era of storytelling, you could argue when certain stories really begin and end, because some of them kind of do that, you know, mid-issue sometimes. But as we've talked about, I think the clone saga was a big deal at the time it came out, and a bigger deal with the ramifications it had way later when they did the more epic clone saga. And by epic, I mean it took, what, how many volumes of epics to tell the later one? Because that story just kept going.
Well, they had four or five books going at the time, and it still took, what, two and a half years?
At least.
Yeah.
And I recall seeing a blog series, The Life of Riley, where one of the editorial people, you know, years after the fact, was kind of recounting what went down and why the story went the way it did. Because it was meant to be, you know, six-issue arc or something that, oh, it's selling, keep going. It's still selling, keep going. And there comes a point where you can only spin the plates for so long, so well. But this story really, you know, set up that story, and they've gone back to the well on the clone stuff a number of times, even currently, with Ben Reilly showing up in Amazing Spider-Man. It's a storyline that I think is never really ever going to go away. And I'd be hard-pressed to name any other plot line that had the same kind of impact, because sure, you know, Doc Ock and the various other villains, you know, show up again, keep coming back, but it's not like they're advancing the same particular plot or plan or something. So it's, I don't know, it's a little unique in that regard for me, at least.
And for those of you who are interested, I know John originally introduced me to it with a little Google searching and checking some internet archives. All 35 parts of that blog are still available and up.
Yeah, the blog is 35 parts. The comic, of course,
it was a lot more.
It's well worth reading the blog. I think you should read the story first, of course. But to find out some of the behind the scenes of, well, we were going to go this way, but then had to go that way.
Yes.
It really gives some good insights as to some of the storytelling challenges, you know, corporate comics have at times, because they're beholden to what's selling and what's not.
Yeah, well, of course. And that was kind of at one of the high points for comics in general. Mm-hmm. And it was probably the hottest magazine on the stands at the time or close to it. That was also the early days of Image, and of course when the X-Men were kings.
Yeah, that was definitely, that clone saga was during the Rockstar era of comics.
Yep.
So, where last we left off, Spidey was all chained up and getting thrown off a bridge.
Yes, and we open up and he's still falling as Gwen the Jackal and a Tarantula watch.
I'm thinking it's going to be a very short story.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he's got time to do a lot of mental exposition or whatnot as he's falling. And one of the things that I didn't see in the scene that I expected to was he's essentially reliving, you know, how Gwen had died. And there was no, I've thought about this day all this time and I have a better game plan now than I did then sort of deal.
Fair enough.
Because we've actually gotten a line or two like that in, I want to say, from Dick Grayson in New Teen Titans during the Judas contract, kind of a thing of, you know, when he's diving out a fourth or fifth story apartment window, you know, falling from roughly the same height his parents died from, you know, it's like, I've had, you know, a decade or two to figure out what I would do in that sort of situation kind of deal. This seemed like the sort of scene where we could have had that. But, you know, he's able to save himself, not necessarily the most gracefully, but the fact that he's falling for, what, 2-3 pages there definitely shows how they can kind of compress time as they need to in comics pretty well.
Yep.
I did think there was a little bit of the writer of how am I gonna get myself out of this? He's got the villains up on top of the bridge. Cops have suddenly shown up. There's nowhere to come but down unless you're going to go fly away. So sure enough, that's what they're going to go do, because the Jackal, having planned brilliantly in advance, has the components of a concealed jetpack in Gwen's jacket.
Yes. Of course it was Gwen's jacket, which makes almost no sense, but yes.
Well, Tarantula's wearing a skin-tight suit. Not really room to hide stuff there. Fair enough. Jackal, at this point, you know, looks like he's just a fur-covered guy. Turns out later it's a suit, but, you know, who knew that at the time?
Yeah.
So he didn't really have anywhere to hide stuff, so the jacket made as much sense as anything.
Fair enough.
Why the Jackal didn't wear the jetpack, but gave it to Tarantula and stuff, I don't know, but, you know, hey, it works.
Because the Jackal was the only guy that understood it, and somebody had to load these insanely small fuel tanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, they look about the size of water bottles.
Maybe. Compared to the mass of the three of them and the size of the components of the jetpack itself, those are really, really small amounts of fuel.
They're solid fuel capsules.
Yes.
Apparently being solid versus hollow makes a big difference.
Well, yes.
Well, they're making good their escape. Spidey's hanging unconscious from his webbing and stuff because he knocked himself out and gets collected by the police. And I thought this stuff was a little over the top, but also just kind of hilarious.
It was hilarious.
Well, this one cop's angling, oh, we're not going to unmask him here. We're going to do it in front of the TV cameras on shore. But we can't have them all chained up, because how would that look? You know, so it was definitely a aspect of media savviness of this cop. Not that his boss or whatever appreciated that when Spidey escapes, but, you know, hey. We also then get a good scene with Peter and Mary Jane, with her confronting him. And it was at about this point I was starting to wonder how Peter had any friends left.
Yeah.
Because the way he acts around his friends sucks. He's ignoring everything she's saying. He slams the door in her face. He realizes afterwards, wait, that was a mistake. But, I mean, come on.
Well, and in the last issue, Mary Jane was so angry. And Aunt May did such a good job of calming her down and bringing her around to Peter's side in just a panel or two. And Peter manages to undo that just as quickly.
Well, blatantly ignoring her and doing the whatever. That'll do it.
Yes, it will.
But the way he's acting there, the way he was acting with Gwen a couple issues back, where he'd first flipped out and, you know, shoved her into the wall or whatever and stuff like that, there are times where he is just not the lovable Peter Parker that we know. And there are times where it's like, how does he hang on to any friends?
Yes.
You know, having Ned swing by and give a little bit more exposition on everything we know about Gwen, she's a clone, this, that, and the other. Exposition, but it made sense for them to compare notes. It actually feels like they're showing us this part versus, I mean, yes, it's exposition they're telling us, but they're at least doing it in the story. So I did appreciate that. And this is where we go see Professor Warren, because somebody had to have access to the cell tissues to clone her. Now, again, as you were saying in the last time we recorded, he's been around, Professor Warren, since early days of Spider-Man. I don't know how much he had been seen, you know, prior to this, but we did four issues last time, and we saw the Jackal. I don't think we saw Professor Warren, that side of him at all. So when he's like, oh, the specimens, they're gone. Okay, maybe he's innocent of it. You know, you don't know at this point.
Well, no, you don't know. And you've got the, you know, you've got the red herring of Anthony.
Yeah, the lab assistant.
Yeah.
And
who just looks evil.
He looks evil, and maybe it's my upbringing. He's the guy cleaning the test tubes.
Yes.
I've read enough Per Degaton stories to know the guy cleaning the test tubes is the evil mastermind.
Yes.
Anyone who doesn't understand that reference, you need to read more JSA. That's all I'm saying. But yeah, this gave them somebody to go chase after, because, of course, you know, you got to have the red herring and such. Now, another question I've got for you, again, not that steeped in this era of Spider-Man. He's going, he's searching this abandoned old factory or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Lights aren't working, so he has to use his spider signal as a spotlight.
Which is the greatest thing ever.
What was the actual original purpose of the spider signal?
I have no idea.
it's clearly not to signal Spider-Man because it's on his belt. He's there.
This era of Spider-Man, it's like somebody was watching the old Batman cartoon and said, he needs some toys. And there are all these weird one-off appearances, things like this, the spider buggy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few of them. Spider-Man got a bunch of very short-lived toys randomly in this era.
Well, again, this is a cool flashlight sort of a thing you could sell. I get it.
Yeah, the Spider-Man face on the end, the red light. It's pure Silver Age-y goodness, even though this is a little bit later than that.
I just don't understand what Peter was thinking when he put it on his belt.
You could scare criminals with it, potentially.
Yeah, because they're a cowardly and superstitious lot. I just think it was more exactly. Batman thing than a Spider-Man thing. And isn't that where he used to keep his camera?
Yes.
So, it works. It makes for some cool visuals here, particularly as he's lighting up Tarantula and then having to go fight him.
Yep.
And, of course, thinks to himself, I'd best not get, scratched from those drug-tipped, things. So, those of us who hadn't read the previous issues, oh, wait, we know what's going on. So, again, playing fair. I appreciate that. And it does, actually, with the light being primarily red and stuff, make Tarantula's costume almost a black and white kind of a thing, which makes for a little better visual than, red and blue guy fighting red and blue guy.
Yeah, no, actually, the art is so simplistic in many ways, but it's also that whole sequence. For a fight that's done in the dark with the red light, I love the art in that sequence, and that crazy spider signal is what makes half of it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we see Tarantula swinging around something. We don't necessarily see what it is, because again, the room's dark and stuff, but it gives a very cinematic feel to the fight.
Absolutely.
Like you said, you just couldn't do anywhere else. Now, what time of day was this? Because there are windows in this place.
Yeah, and when they go outside, it's broad daylight. Why the giant windows didn't provide, it's an old factory. They were greasy and dirty.
Sure, that works. We'll go with that. So, Tarantula's not a bad character. I don't think he gets used that much these days, but I don't think he ever kind of made it into the upper echelon of Spider-Man villains.
I don't think he got used much other than this story, a whole lot. I mean, he'd get used here and there, but like you know.
Exactly. Here and there, and that's about it. He's not a go-to Spider-Man villain.
No, but this is his shining moment. He's introduced in kind of the setup to this. Clearly, you've got his role here, and this is as big as he ever gets or as important as he ever gets.
Now, again, not being a New Yorker, don't really know my way around and stuff, but there seem to be a lot of rooftop water towers, which makes sense. You got to get the water up there so you have the water pressure, all that kind of stuff. But in this one, Spider-Man is able to defeat the Tarantula by essentially tricking him to trying to spear him with his boot or tip spikes or whatever, going through a billboard and puncturing the water tower behind him, which of course then goes, flooding out as he knocks Tarantula out of it. So that's one water tower down.
The visual with the billboard and the beer ad and where it get the, again, I just love the art.
Well, it's funny because in the bottom one, it's shooting out where the beer can would have opened.
Yes.
But when he went through the thing to begin with, he went through the can part, not the top part.
Yes, that is true.
So I think they could have done a little better on that, but still, it's a great visual there at the end.
Yeah.
But I've got to imagine it does not endear Spider-Man to various apartment dwellers.
Yeah, that would be true.
How come I've got no water pressure and there's stuff, seeping in from the roof? And then at the end here, again, one of these last page kind of reveals Ned's been captured and we find out the professor is the Jackal.
Yes.
Which you at least see that, but again, end on a strong moment. So.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful issue or moment and reveal. And again, a pretty big deal. I've just kind of always known, and I came in long after this, that Professor Warren was the Jackal. But yeah, I mean, at this point, I guess that's a pretty big reveal.
Well, let's stop and talk about that for a moment, because I've always been very anti-spoilers. And there's an aspect of reading old comics where if you've read the series later, you know certain things like that.
Yes.
So it's not like somebody spoiled the story, but you're going in with spoilers nonetheless.
Yes.
And it's hard to know Professor Warren is the Jackal and not see that the entire time you're reading this. So, oh, when he's sending you against, you know, after the lab assistant, you know it's a trap because you know that, you know?
Of course.
So that's why if somebody doesn't know a major story point, say, oh, well, the story's been out since 1973. It can't be a spoiler. It is. Not everyone's read the story.
Yes.
Which is why in the show notes it says what issues we're covering, yada, yada, so you've got the chance to make the decision.
Yeah.
But yeah, these are various things where reading this story, knowing these things, the subsequent clone sagas after it, and so forth, we're going in with a lot of baggage that the people who are reading this off the rack at the time would not have had in any way, shape, or form. So the reveal here, very strong moment to end on.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when we get to that next issue, which once again is picking up right on the heels of this one. Matter of fact, it's feeling like most of these issues are doing that.
Yes.
Have there been any in this whole thing where we've had it more than a moment or two happen between issues?
Yeah.
I'm not thinking of any at the moment, so.
No, me neither.
It, again, gives that never-ending saga kind of a feel. And then, you know, spend that page early on, in this case, page two, of let's do a quick recap of what you need to know to figure out what's going on if you missed the last few issues or something. Again, got to appreciate that they play fair. I think the best way to sum up this issue is Professor Warren snapped.
Oh,
a couple of times.
Well, okay, I'm not sure.
Okay, he snapped when Gwen died.
Yes, and everything else, at that point you just go, he's insane, everything else kind of leads from there.
I think there were a few times even after that, he snaps further.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. When he kills Serbia, yes, absolutely.
That seemed to be when he creates the Jackal persona.
Yep.
There's, you know, a moment or two later in the story arc where he seems to snap yet again. He is not the least bit of a stable individual.
Absolutely. And modern psychology theory would tell you, you know, things can happen that way with particularly stressful events. I don't know if Gwen's death exactly qualifies for him, but, you know.
It seemed to for him because for some reason he'd grown very attached to her as a kind of a father figure. Not that she saw him that way, but it was the daughter he never had in his mind, which in and of itself is a little weird. There is a what-if story to be had here of what if all this stuff with Professor Warren didn't happen and Anthony Serba became the Jackal because he was the one who had the cloning technology.
Yeah.
And I'm actually surprised they haven't told that story as far as I know. But using Serba to clone two of the samples, which one we know is Gwen, later we find out the other is Peter, and then Serba kind of flips out of, you told me they were rats, why are they growing into humans?
Yep.
Again, you know, Warren kind of snaps, kills him, and, well, it wasn't me who did it, it was the Jackal. It's like, kind of nuts. This is almost seeming, I don't say like more of a Batman villain than a Spider-Man villain, but kind of.
Yeah, I can see that.
The montage of over the next several months, he had to take care of the clones, design the Jackal equipment, train himself athletically, and, you know, still hold his day job. This dude was busy.
Well, yes.
And all the while, you know, doing the recreation of Gwen and such, they kind of dance over the how do the clones age faster to the target point, and then you kind of lock them into a normal aging, theoretically. And somehow figured out how to hypnotize her to have control over this Gwen and stuff like that. There's a lot packed in those couple of pages as to the, here's the backstory we hadn't seen.
Yep.
And it explains a lot about clone Gwen and all of that. All of this, of course, while Jackal has his Spidey captive. They do fight briefly at that point, and there is one point or two where the Jackal claws Spider-Man.
Yes.
And I've got to assume this is the injection he refers to later.
Absolutely, it's got to be.
It was not clear that was the case until, you know, afterwards. But this whole, you know, come to Shea Stadium tonight at midnight and we'll do the showdown there. Like, dude, you know it's a trap. I was a little surprised when we then cut to Jameson's office at the Bugle and Betty is there because she's really not played much of a part in this story.
I don't think we've seen her. She might have been standing there with Ned at the very in the hospital, but
I think she was.
But other than that, I don't think she's appeared in this story.
I don't think she's spoken in this story.
She certainly hasn't spoken.
So for her to be, you know, here in such a sad shape or whatever, because Gwen's missing and such, because apparently that's where Gwen's been staying with her or whatever. Okay. Peter saying he hadn't seen Ned in over a week was a little suspicious, particularly given what comes in another page or two, but presumably it's just Peter covering for not having an answer on where Ned is. Although he knows where Ned is. Well, actually, did he leave Ned with the jackal? We don't know.
He did. Didn't he?
He wakes up. Ned's there with him. He breaks free. We don't really see Ned in the remainder of that scene. Cut to the flashback. Cut back. Show up at Shea Stadium. And then we cut to there. So, they don't really say what happened to Ned.
Yeah. I mean, he was on the table next to Peter. And then that whole table's missing. So, which is odd as well.
I would have assumed Peter had taken Ned somewhere. Or Spider-Man had. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But that part of the storytelling is unclear.
That is true.
Because the minute Spidey gets to Shea Stadium, he gets scratched by the jackal, goes unconscious, and then two Spider-Men wake up. And this is, to me, the classic part of the clone saga, this clone saga.
Of course.
And really, it's surprising how little of the story this is. Because we've been covering, you know, an 8-issue arc, including the next two we'll get to. And we've got the two Spider-Men face-to-face for just a couple of pages.
Yep.
Pivotal pages, but yeah. And we've got Ned here as the, he's going to get blown up unless one of you, and only the right one of you, saves him. How removing some RNA, you know, cells removes memory or whatever, it's like, okay. It seems to go with the theory of genetic memory, which makes as much sense of it as anything if the clones are going to wind up with the same memory, so sure, we'll go with it. But the bomb having the sensitivity to the real Spider-Man, not the fake, don't know how that works, but okay. Of course, I'm not sure how the Jackal would know how that works, given it was Serba who had the cloning technology.
But wasn't he his assistant, ultimately?
Yeah, I could never really tell how hands-on Warren was with the cloning stuff. Was it Serba saying it worked and just telling his boss because he'd been checking up on the thing, or was it his experiment that did it?
Yeah.
Presumably, it had to be Warren's experiment, because everything that happens afterwards. But they could have been a little clearer on that. I was a little unsurprised but annoyed that the two Spider-Men were fighting. I would have thought Peter would have had enough sense of responsibility to team up with the clone and save Ned first, if they could figure out how.
Well, but I think that's the key, if they could figure out how.
They're too busy fighting each other to try to think about it. I do love how the scoreboard is doing the countdown for them.
Yes.
Which, of course, had to be why they used Shea Stadium. I loved how it was Gwen who breaks free of her hypnotic conditioning, confronts the Jackal that he's a murderer, which unsurprisingly causes him to snap yet again. He can't take that. He can't be a murderer. So he, the Jackal born, goes and saves Ned and seemingly gets blown up.
Yes.
So this is third or fourth time I think Warren kind of snapped. Like I said, not the most stable of people. Now, it looked to me like one of the Spider-Men had been under when the scoreboard remains and stuff like that crashed down.
Yes.
The other one had saved Ned.
Yep.
And the surviving Spider-Man, I guess, assumes the other one died, although we see his arm sticking out. And then, you know, it's like, hey, he's gone. He's telling Gwen. So I don't know if Gwen just didn't notice the other Spider-Man there or kind of what was going on there.
Well, no, because they talk about it and they say, oh, he's gone.
Yeah, but then
it's
the
weird
next
because
time
his
we
arms...
see the body, Peter's got it. Well, in this issue, we see the arm sticking
out.
Next panel.
Yeah.
Next panel,
yeah,
okay. It's gone. But in the next issue, Peter's got
yes.
it. So
yes, he does.
I couldn't tell. It was unclear to me what they thought was going on.
Fair enough.
The two epilogues where Gwen breaks up with Peter and heads off, and then Peter reunites with Mary Jane, definitely kind of closing that off. Do we see Gwen again prior to when she showed up decades later? I want to say under the Straczynski run?
I do not believe so.
Wow. That, even with her as a clone, is surprising. That seems like the kind of character they would have, again, would have expected them to bring back. So really, we've got the two Spider-Man there for, what, five pages?
Something like that, yeah.
Six, if you count the voiceover where he's off-panel. So those six pages fueled countless stories down the line.
Yeah, but again, it took them 20 years to go back to it.
Yeah, but it seems like they haven't left it since.
That may be true.
Because, yeah, it did take 20 years for them to bring that back. It took even longer to get the clone Gwen back. But you then look at what they've done not only during the following clone saga, but then with the Scarlet Spider after it and the other clones after all of that kind of stuff. I just think at this point in time, they didn't go back to the well as often. Part of it is the well wasn't as deep and they hadn't played through as many storylines at that point.
Yes.
150, though, was kind of an interesting, granted, you know, bit of an anniversary issue or what have you. And he's like, am I man or am I clone? And I love it when they do these kinds of follow-up storylines where they actually dwell on the ramifications, the consequences, and so forth of the story. And him heading over to Doc Connors' lab makes sense. It looks pretty spiffy and super high-tech, but hey, that's cool. Doc helping out with him makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Falls in line. Surprising they don't really mention him being the Lizard that much, if at all.
Okay.
And I was very puzzled by what was going on with the villains kind of calling him out, fighting, and then vanishing. I never really... That part of the story never clicked for me. What am I missing?
What now? I'm sorry.
Well, in 150, he fights the Vulture, then yeah. Sandman, then Kingpin, and then the Spider Slayer.
Yes.
The first three just kind of, you know, Vulture seems to explode, Sandman just vanishes, Kingpin vanishes, you know, all of that. But it doesn't seem like it was a dream sequence, but it doesn't seem like it was really those guys either.
It wasn't. It was robots.
Where did they... Maybe I just missed that.
I don't know if they explicitly said it. At least that's the way I always read it, is that was Smith, the robotic genius, had created them. Spencer Smith... You know, it set up the gauntlet. He went through the three villain robots to get to the tank robot that Smith himself was in.
Your nightmare is far from run its course. Where does he...
He doesn't explicitly say it. That's just the way I read it. And maybe I'm making it up.
That's a fair reading of it. It makes as much sense as anything else.
Yeah.
I just don't feel... I don't think they were explicit enough for it for me. Not the three humanoid robots designed to look and react like your former friend. Nope, it's there.
Okay.
I missed that. My
Fair
bad.
Enough.
And then on sufficient impact, self-destruct.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like something he would have done. That feels almost more like Arcade.
It does.
That I think, is why it didn't really play for me, is it felt out of character for him.
Yeah.
Because I don't think before or since we've seen him show that level of aptitude for creating realistic humanoids. Granted, in the Marvel Universe, we've seen those, you know, left, right, and center. So I guess I shouldn't be too surprised. It must be much easier there than it is here. But the whole bit of Peter realizing that the clone couldn't have the emotional response that the real person would have must be why he's the real person. Okay, it fits. It seems like the kind of thing he would think and believe. But after going through all of that work with Doc Connors and all that testing and stuff, to go back and then just toss the lab results off the rooftop instead of reading them? I don't know. Seems a little... Not even sure what the right word for that would be.
Yeah, and we'll get to it at the end of the next issue. Because, while I love this story, and I love the next Clone Saga, there's a giant hole between them.
Yeah, let's talk about the next one, and let's address that hole and...
Absolutely.
...what you feel about all that stuff. This, I think, left the door open for some aspects there.
Absolutely did.
It just feels like Peter was a little irresponsible.
Oh, yeah.
So the next issue was 151. It felt like the epilogue kind of sort of the Clone Saga and really the start of the next story arc.
Yes. And this, I remember when we were discussing how to break this up. And I was like, we've got to do 151. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, we didn't have to do 150. But it's hard to skip the giant anniversary issue with all the fights in the middle.
I think you have to, if only for the framing sequence at the lab.
Yeah.
I think the fight and all of that is extraneous to the main story.
Yep.
Likewise, I think 151 here is essential for the opening couple of pages.
Absolutely.
where Spidey is dumping the clone body.
Yep.
I mean, he goes to a incineration plant, and, you know, we get a clear shot. It's a Spider-Man clone with Peter's face.
Yep.
I've got to get rid of this. One of me's enough. And he dumps it down the smokestack.
Yep. And at this point, I do want to point out the tingling and the spider sense and the idea he's being watched. Because it's the one possible gap filler to my complaint we'll get to at the end.
Okay. There was another time where his spider sense kind of went off and it didn't make sense to me.
I agree.
Yeah. This scene here, despite it being very much an epilogue of sorts to the story, is one of the main things they would flash back to.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, him throwing that body down the chimney is vital.
Well, it's not just vital, it's one of the two signature visuals they would typically use.
Yeah.
You'd have the two Spideys on the field at Shea Stadium fighting, and yep. You'd have the body thrown into the smokestack. That's the Clone Saga in the recaps.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we didn't mention it when we started this issue, as we talked about at the beginning of the last episode. This is where Len Wein takes over as writer.
Mm-hmm.
Also, for those interested, John Romita does some of the art in here, which is a change. It's been Ross Andrew, who also is listed as an artist on this book, up until this point.
It's worth pointing out, in 150, the writer was Archie Goodwin, the artist was Gil Kane, and the editor was Marv Wolfman.
Yeah. That anniversary issue is completely kind of out of the regular Spider-Man continuity. Not really, but yeah, it's an anomaly issue.
It's a, I don't want to say a fill-in issue, it's a special anniversary issue with a framing sequence to fit it into the sequence.
Exactly.
You know, it could have been Spidey was at the Daily Bugle instead of at Doc Connors' lab. The fight ensues, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Or just ditch the framing sequence entirely. Add another villain. So once we get past, you know, the ditching of the body, we then kind of start into the next arc. We get Flash Thompson showing up. He's back. He's now an XGI focusing on his education. Harry's back from the institution.
Yep.
J. Jonah's throwing a party for Ned Leeds and Betty Brant. It becomes clear the two are getting married, but I don't know that we've really gotten that through any of these issues yet so far.
Yeah, only because the only time it could have come up was when she was so upset. But at the time, she plays it off because Gwen's missing, who was staying with her.
Yeah, but the fact there was the upcoming wedding and stuff like that, marriage and stuff.
Yeah.
There were other places it could have come up.
Absolutely.
So at first, I was trying to figure out why Jonah was throwing the party, why Peter and his friends were invited, but once I realized that's what it was for, it's like, oh, this all makes sense. I will say, the party scene, first off, is fun. We get to see J. Jonason, you know, at his best, having a bunch of people in his house that he doesn't want there. But the whole rolling blackout stuff, Shocker being behind it, and the whole he's trying to spell his name out with the blackouts and stuff was hilarious.
Oh, yeah, and very Shocker.
Yeah, yeah. I also thought Peter taking the police copter as the way out of Jameson's party and stuff, and having to basically just throw his clothes off to change into his costume and such. Kind of hilarious. I hope he at least kept his wallet somehow. Don't know how that would work. You know, if this were ever to be, you know, used in a cartoon or movie or whatever, you would cut to some bum on the street as it's raining clothes.
Yeah.
But when we got to, you know, him seeing the Shocker, you know, name and lights and stuff, that was just kind of hilarious. Figuring he's then doing that by doing something to the cables beneath the streets and stuff. Again, I'm not a New Yorker, but sure, okay, that makes as much sense as anything. I don't know that I would want to fight the Shocker. I guess his power is more vibrational stuff than electrical shocking. But there was an aspect where he's causing blackouts, there's electrical issues. I don't know that I'd want to fight somebody in the water in that kind of situation.
No, of course not.
But, you know, I expect Peter to be a little smarter than that. Good use of the Shocker, though. It was fun, good fight scene, and we end on another cliffhanger, so we know the next issue's got to really pick up right on the heels of this one.
Yes.
So, I would say, in terms of the Clone Saga, really only the first handful of pages are relevant. Not a bad issue, though. None of these are bad issues.
No, none of these are bad issues.
I do think there's a couple of things Spidey should have done throughout this arc.
Okay.
One, be nicer to his friends. I don't think he was very good to them most of the time. I think he should have read that lab report.
Of course.
I think he should have checked the clone body better. He clearly thought it was dead. We later learned it clearly was not. And the next one, you could argue either way. I think he should have done a better job cremating the body, provided it was dead. Since it wasn't, I'm glad he didn't. But yeah, there are a couple of things where, yeah, he could have done better. So it takes, what, 20-ish years, give or take, for the Clone Saga to get revisited. It did, as we talked about, in grand fashion. What are the holes you see between this and that?
Okay, and it's alluded to in upcoming issues, but essentially just left. If you remember, the Clone Saga starts with the return of a clone, but it's not Ben Reilly. It's the deformed Kane, who is essentially, we're told, is a degraded earlier version that the Jackal created to test how long the clones would live before creating Gwen and Ben.
But there was no sense of that whatsoever here.
Not in this part, no. And like I said, it is alluded to with a page or two in each of the next 10 to 15 issues. But they get out of it by ultimately using that guy, who you could argue would have been Kane, mm-hmm. as the return of Doc Ock. Mm. So it's not him. There's this shadowy figure that's kind of a bum wandering the street. And he ends up, when that character is finally revealed and comes back, it's Doc Ock. So yeah, the entire start and a big portion of the Clone Saga is based on there being an earlier clone that's never mentioned, never shown, arguably couldn't exist based on what we saw with the Gwen clone and how she was originally brought to life, I guess is the right word.
Yeah, there's no evidence of a third clone whatsoever.
Yeah, particularly one that's older than the two we do see.
Yeah, yeah, agreed.
So yeah, that's, like I said, it's this weird giant plot hole. And like I said, there is that sequence where he feels he's being watched when he's disposing of the body.
Well, and also, I think it was in the final epilogue in 149 where Peter's going up to his apartment. He's about to see Mary Jane, and his spider sense goes off there.
Yeah.
Oh, someone in my apartment. Mary Jane wasn't a threat. That wouldn't have triggered it.
Yeah.
So I think they were setting something up there. I just don't know if where they thought they were going and where later writers thought they were going.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, for the collectors and those types, like I said, it can be argued that some of those things are allusions to Kane, but ultimately, you know, you go through Overstreet. First appearance of Kane's listed as Web, 119, I think?
Yeah, that makes sense. It feels like he was a retcon based on what you're saying and what we saw here.
Yeah, and what's interesting is if you know that going, not that he was retcon, but you know he exists, and you go back and read this stuff, there's a character that's set up to be that guy. And then, like I said, it's like Len either decided he didn't like the idea or whatever, and they just went, yeah, the bum we've been following, the trench coat's Doc Ock. Okay.
Yeah, interesting.
So yeah, that's the only thing, again, having read it the way, both of us did, reading the new Clone Saga first before going back.
Yeah. The other question I've got is, do we see the clone Spider-Man using web shooters?
Absolutely.
That begs the question of not only where did he get the costume, where did he get the web shooters?
Or he made them.
When? We don't know where this clone Peter was during the months that Gwen was getting hypnotized and all that stuff.
Well, and that's the thing. You assume he was going through something similar, and he's got all of Peter's memories, assuming clones work the same for both of them.
No reason to think they wouldn't, so yeah.
Yeah, he's got all the memories and stuff. So the knowledge of how to make web shooters, knowing he's Spider-Man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing that's arguably unclear is if that's where Miles discovers Peter's Spider-Man, or he already knew.
I would think he had to know, because why else clone Peter?
Because if it's your daughter, if it's a daughter-style relationship, why wouldn't you bring back her husband, significant other as well?
Because he's still alive?
That's true. But it's also potentially the one that killed her. So you can go back to the one that didn't go through that.
But you've got the ability to wipe the memory. I mean, I see what you're saying, and I don't disagree with it. I'm just...
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and that's why I don't think it's dealt with. It's like, Gwen came back, and We're going to basically explain how she got back to being fully who she was and knowing everything she knows. So Peter was the same.
If there had been a line from Warren on how he had brought them both back and he was going to replace the real Peter with the substitute Peter to give Gwen back the happy life as if those horrible events had never happened.
Yeah.
Because for them, they hadn't. That would make perfect sense.
But again, by the time he could do that exposition, we're supposed to believe he's dead. And you didn't want to ruin the story of the two Spider-Men until that panel.
Yeah.
Like I said, I understand why it was done the way it was done.
They could have basically added a page when Gwen was confronting him at the beginning, or really between those couple of panels of the spell is worn off and you're a murderer.
Yes.
And done it there.
It's the only place. Because like I said, You don't want to mention it before the reading audience sees that panel with the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. It just feels like the clone Spider-Man at this point was a plot device, not a character.
Absolutely.
And he's become an enduring character after this.
Oh, yeah. Ben Reilly's, at this point, been around, what, 40-ish years?
Yeah.
No, 30. That's 94, so not quite 30.
Twice as long as Spider-Man had been around at this point.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, I think this is a good read. I'm glad we did it. Like I said, I'd never actually read through the full thing. I was aware of the highlights of the story. He was cloned. They fought. Peter thought he was the real one. Disposed of the body. Later learned, maybe not.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more to the story than that.
There is. And like I said, the one kind of hole is all of that hinges on the existence of Kane, which doesn't seem possible in this story.
Yeah. No, I agree. It doesn't fit the narrative here.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Clone Saga from the 90s would be fun to do, but it is gargantuan.
It's insane. I mean, there were weeks I remember going to the shop and getting 2 and 3 issues.
Yeah. I don't know how we could break that down into a manageable amount.
There are 5 Epic collectors. There were the Epic storylines, which were the precursor to the current Epic line.
Mm-hmm.
There are 5 of them. Each of them have about 20 issues in them. Yeah, it'd be a project for years.
Yeah. If listeners have thoughts as to how we could do it into a manageable amount, I'm game for considering it. But that's more than I'm willing to kind of take on at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it had some great stuff. I loved the Scarlet Spider and a lot of what they were doing at that point. This, again, some classic Spider-Man stuff here.
It also got us, and personally, I've never been a big Venom fan, it got us out of the symbiotes for a while, which I think is one of the reasons I like the Clone Saga. You know, Kane shows up, Spidey's fighting Venom. And we'd just been through Carnage, and you know, it was like, oh, thankfully there's something else they've got an idea with other than just Venom and Venom clones.
Yeah, yeah. At some point, we should consider doing the start of the black costume stuff.
Absolutely.
Because that was when I got on board. We just have to figure out again what's the right couple issues to do, because they were multiple titles at the time. I don't remember if they were bouncing between or not.
Yeah, and it's weird. I remember. There's a podcast that specifically covers the Marvel Epic Collection. Mm-hmm. It comes out rather sporadically. But one of the things, besides doing the reviews of different various Epic Collections, Curtis also does interviews very often with many of the creators.
Mm.
And I believe he had Tom DeFalco on once. Well, matter of fact, I'm sure he had Tom DeFalco on once. And he was talking about the black costume and how it kind of got thrust upon him. And I don't remember if it was him or Jim Shooter, who was the editor at the time. It got kind of thrust on both of them. And one of them in particular, which is why Spidey rips it off and gets rid of it kind of when he does.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be the end of it. And it wasn't until he was the editor-in-chief a few years later and he needed to figure out something to do with Spider-Man that he went back to that issue and came up with Venom.
Oh, that's funny. Waste not, want not.
Yeah, exactly.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, I remember him specifically being asked, hey, was that the idea when he ripped the suit off and you see it rolling down the hill? And he goes, no, I just wanted to be done with that stupid thing.
Well, I'd be game for doing a couple issues either right around the time the black costume starts or maybe a little later when Black Cat was a big factor and stuff. I would love to do at some point, I want to say it was Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man 98, 99, and 100 that had the first arc with Spot.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I like the character. He's totally ridiculous and lame, but he was fun.
Yeah.
So, tons of stuff we could do.
Absolutely.
Hopefully people enjoyed this two-part look at the Clone Saga.
Yep.
Anything else?
I'm good.
Cool. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next preview spotlight.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.